Okay, appropriate sound effects. The 1944 atomic bomb explosion done by the U.S. military-industrial complex under semi-controlled laboratory conditions in Port Chicago and the San Francisco Bay, about 30 miles inland from the sea, which left 321 dead, mostly African-American volunteers for the U.S. Navy, who were being used to load ammunition onto cargo ships for the war in the Pacific when the bomb was detonated, to see what would happen 1 year, literally a calendar year, before the Trinity test, the first official atomic bomb test in New Mexico. It was a success. Some people are asking, well, what happened to the radiation? Who's to say there wasn't radiation there? I don't remember seeing any stories about radioactive detectors being used and all the rest of it. It was all lies. It was all covered up. It was a terrible, terrible thing to do to this country. But certainly, we know that the military-industrial complex has been releasing biological weapons into such areas as U.S. subways, railroad stations, sprayed all around the edge of San Francisco Bay by boats, just to see how the bacteria would spread from person to person, etc. We have a long history of doing things that are catastrophic to the U.S. public here. It's nothing new. Walter Wilkinson has been with us twice before. This is our third part in the discussion about the Port Chicago atomic bomb, which absolutely happened, no question about it. And we're going to find out even more tonight with Walter. Welcome back, Walter. Thank you for being here. This has been a real pleasure to learn all this.
Thank you, Jeff. It's really an honor. I have one more thing to mention about Port Chicago, and which was a uranium bomb, which was dropped on Hiroshima. And I have a new book to make your listeners aware of. It's up on the pictures page, and it would be a good idea if they navigated there now.
Got it. Go ahead. Let's go to the program banner on the top left of the homepage. Jeff Rentz program, tonight's guest, click here and look in the center, Walter Wilkinson, photos. Pull that up and you'll see at the top Captain William Parsons, the architect of Port Chicago. Underneath you can find the Wikipedia entry. I've put that there as well. And then a fascinating picture of Oppenheimer, an even more remarkable picture of Teller, Dr. Strangelove. Wow. And then Daisy Herndon's book, and then another book by David Dionysi, and that's called Atomic Bomb Secrets. All right, and then we have two photographs. So go ahead, Walter.
Okay. So the picture shows the cover to Dionysi's book, which you can download from Amazon as a Kindle book.
Okay.
And there's a paragraph of text here which I'll read because it isn't that often that an author will do this and put a paragraph of text.
Walter, excuse me, Walter. Your audio is not as good as it usually is. Are you on a different phone or doing anything different?
Okay.
Maybe get a little closer to the phone. Yeah, I think that is. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. So it says, the United States Strategic Bombing Survey interviewed hundreds of Japanese leaders after the war and concluded that Japan would have surrendered in 1945 without the use of the atomic bomb, without a U.S. invasion, and without Russia entering the Pacific War. So we could ask, why did we drop the bomb on Japan, this defeated nation, which didn't have any air defense left? And its navy had been sunk. And you hear it all the time that the participants in this will congratulate themselves for having shortened the war, but actually that's not true. And one of the first paragraphs in this book, he mentions that the Smithsonian Institution was going to have a 50th anniversary exhibit. And in May of 1995, it was canceled because the historical facts showing that the atom bombs did not save lives threatened to unravel five decades of lies. The director of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum said 50 years may not be enough time to prepare the nation to confront such a history. So the use of the atom bomb did not shorten the war.
And you know, I might suggest, if I might, hold on, I want to put this on the table too. It has been argued by more than a few that we didn't need those grueling, terrible, bloody horrors going island hopping in the Pacific to defeat the Japanese. We could have simply, since they had lost their navy and the ability to project protection from supply ships, we could have simply cut the islands off from food and water, etc., medicine, and they would have surrendered island by island. Yes. It would have taken time. That's basically true. But we had so much armament, so much weaponry, so much ammunition built up that we had to use it up. So that's why the Pacific island hopping campaign was basically held. That's one of the reasons. Go ahead, please.
Well, so David Dionysi's very startling main thesis is that, well, if we look at that picture from the cover, we see a sort of triangular, it's a bird's eye view of Nagasaki. And in the middle there, inside the six button-like black circles, there is something that looks like it's been blackened and ruined. And that was ground zero for Nagasaki. And that isn't the story that the U.S. military has told. And they've changed their story several times about what the intended target for the Nagasaki bomb. And that bomb was the only plutonium bomb which we had. And the plutonium bomb was the deluxe advanced technology bomb.
That probably was our work. But again, I'd like to mention it, that the other bomb was a uranium bomb, and we have reason to believe that the 1,500 pounds of processed uranium captured when U-234 surrendered in the middle of the Atlantic, along with two complete Messerschmitt 262s on board, among many other things, we think that that may have been a German uranium bomb that we put together and dropped on Hiroshima. Go ahead.
Yes, and David Dionysi does mention that in his book. The interesting thing he mentions is that the reason it was going from Germany to Japan was that Japan actually had a more advanced atom bomb program, which might come as a little bit of a surprise.
Interesting.
But the discussion in Dionysi's book, which I'm going to be focusing on this time around, is actually the plutonium bomb, which was used on Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that, if I might go back to that picture, that center round circle with the six smaller dots around it, that black hole right there, so to speak, that was ground zero, or at least it was an airburst, and it was above ground zero. That was the center of the detonation, though, right?
Yes, and I can cite a information source, which is basically the most reliable information source which can be imagined. But I can back that up.
Yeah, good.
But the official telling of the story was that the intended target was 3 miles away, a shipyard which was called the Mitsubishi Shipyard, and it is still there. If we look at pictures before and after the bomb was dropped, it wasn't damaged. But if we look at, if we scroll down, just skip over that that link to Miles Mathis. I had attended that as sort of a footnote at the end. I won't be referring to it. But if we scroll down, we can see this beautiful sun-drenched cathedral with the reddish brown.
A Christian cathedral, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it was the Lady of the Immaculate Conception in English cathedral, and that site had been used as the center of Christian life, not just in Japan, but all of East Asia since the time of Saint Francis Xavier in 1549. So when it was blown up in 1945, it was only 5 years away from its 400th year as being the center of Christian life in Japan. And if we scroll down, we see what it looked like after it was devastated by the bomb. So that is the circular black hole we mentioned in the cover. But if we look at the cover again and think of kind of pulling back a little, David Dionysi says it looks just like an all-seeing eye, and it was intended that way. That the architecture after the war was created by a compendium of secret societies, which together he calls the Brotherhood of Death. A well-known one is at Yale University, Skull and Bones.
So oh, yeah. We might. I have no problem believing that. No, it's perfectly logical, in line with what we know these people do on the planet.
Yeah.
Pretty damned evil. Yeah.
And the question come up. It could be very useful to understand who specifically decided that Nagasaki would be the target. And skipping all the way to the end, that man was Harold, Henry L. Stimson.
Yes, and Admiral Stimson. Yeah.
Harold Stimson, okay. He had been Secretary of War for three U.S. presidents, starting with President Taft way back, and then skipping over a number of presidential terms. He was the Secretary of War both for FDR and after FDR died with Harry Truman. And Stimson was a Bonesman. He was a Yale member of Skull and Bones. And if you in Dionysi's book, he mentioned some places where it points out that Stimson was more powerful than FDR or Harry Truman, and they just sort of gave him carte blanche. An interesting thing, which I've mentioned in our, I think the last our last discussion, there's a connection between the University of California at Berkeley and the atom bomb program. And I left out one. I left out a key instance of that. But if we look at any chemistry classroom in the country, including high school chemistry classes, there's going to be a big chart of the periodic table of the elements. And all the way at the end are these ephemeral new elements, which only last for a fraction of a second in a cyclotron. And one of them is called californium.
Yeah.
One is called berkelium. Are we getting closer?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
after that, there's one which is called lawrencium, which was named after Dr. Ernest Lawrence, after which the government weapons laboratory at Livermore, California, Lawrence Livermore. That's where the name came from. But what isn't so well known is that during 1944 and the work on the atom bomb at Los Alamos, Berkeley was something like the administrator, maybe the owner. I don't know that the correct term, but Los Alamos was another of Berkeley's properties. But what I didn't mention last time is this. If we look at the there's a Wikipedia article which mentions another Berkeley property in California in Sonoma County. It's
I know what you're getting at.
Okay, it's Bohemian Grove.
And that's where they have their for any of you who don't know, that's the annual meeting of the skull and bones sorts of evil elite in this country and abroad. They come to Bohemian Grove. Yep.
And reading directly from the Wikipedia article, the Grove is particularly famous for a Manhattan Project planning meeting that took place there in September 1942, which subsequently led to the atomic bomb. So it mentions some famous attendees. There's Ernest Lawrence, who I just mentioned. There's J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was the director of Los Alamos Laboratory, though he was vividly underqualified as a scientist, and he previously had been expelled from Cambridge University and for leaving a poisoned apple for one of the laboratory staff who he didn't like.
This man has been given far too much credit, and he has been lionized far beyond what reality would allow. He's another creation of the media, when you think about it, in my view. I've never been impressed with the guy. I just don't. He's creepy. Chicken livers? Come on, the king of the chicken livers.
Yeah, and he was a... I just saw a few minutes ago a publication from Los Alamos which mentions some reminiscences of Oppenheimer, and the most notable thing they said was his endless chain-smoking, including when he was lecturing, and he did in fact die of throat cancer at the age of 62.
Another tribe member who got there because of the control element. He didn't necessarily earn his way there from his scientific acumen and competence. The guy was, in my view, vastly overrated, but that's what we have.
Yeah, one notch up from him in the hierarchy was John von Neumann, and I may have mentioned this before, but he was like the headmaster of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey, at the time Albert Einstein was there, and von Neumann had 150 publications in prestigious physics and mathematics journals. And Oppenheimer was listed as co-author on one. So if we think of
one.
Oppenheimer's, 0.5 basically versus 150. So it's a mystery to me as to why von Neumann would put up with it. However, it looks like according to this book, Atomic Secrets, Atomic Bomb Secrets. Henry Stimson may have been the person who decided in favor of Oppenheimer. So there are these famous people at this meeting in September of 1942. Lawrence was there. Oppenheimer was there. Harold Urey was there. There are three people who already at that time were Nobel laureates. But it also mentions that... some other people there at this meeting were captains of industry and oil companies and General Electric and so on. And so you could ask, it's not a huge group, so why couldn't it have been held at Berkeley where they have, they have all kinds of facilities for having guests who are famous scientists. But it was held at Los Alamos, and... So, David Dionysi's book points out how the reason we used the plutonium bomb on Nagasaki and specifically on the cathedral was that it actually was pretty effective in knocking, giving a knockout blow to Christianity in Japan. And today I did a little fact-checking.
Mm-hmm.
Using Google, I just asked, I was aware that Christianity seems to be growing in Korea and among Korean Americans in this country. I hope I can remember the numbers. But I asked, what percentage of people in Korea are Christians? And I think as many as 46% said no religion. And if I'm remembering correctly, it was maybe 23% said Buddhist, but 26% said Christian. So among those who stated a religion, according to this, Christianity is by a little bit most popular religion in Korea. And you do the same experiment with Japan, and it says that 1.5%, I think, of Japanese profess to be Christians. And I've read that people who visit Japan and who are Christians and were hoping to see what it's like to visit a Sunday service in Japan say you just can't find one. So, and in Dainese's book, he points out that the history of Christianity in Japan, which started with St. Francis Xavier and in 1549, sometimes the Christians were in favor with the emperor and sometimes they were not. So early in the going, the emperor of the day ordered all of his samurai warriors to convert to Christianity. But then later, the emperor of the day, maybe it was the same one, I don't know, but he had heard that from some source, that the Christians intended to depose him. So he took 26 Christians from Nagasaki, and they were crucified. And so in the artworks for the cathedral, the sort of featured motif was the 26 holy martyrs of Nagasaki.
Huh.
But after that, Christianity had been growing in Japan, and in Dionysius' book, he goes into some depth with that. So the dropping of the plutonium bomb directly on the cathedral was effective in wielding a knockout blow to Christianity in Japan, and it hasn't recovered since then.
It's interesting. Looking at the pictures, Walter, is that the after picture shows that actually quite a bit of the cathedral is still standing, while there's nothing around it anywhere standing. It's all burned to ash. And maybe it's because it was made of brick. I don't know, but that is very interesting. One wonders if they rebuilt from that original structure or tore it all down and started over. I don't know.
Well, it is true that in those days, the typical dwelling of Japanese people were made of paper and wood, and that's why they burned so ferociously. Yeah. Now, I found that it's pretty well known to Americans that there was a B-29 raids over Tokyo just about at the same time where 100,000 people lost their lives. They were incinerated in Tokyo using conventional weapons like napalm.
The B-29s were flying over Tokyo so low it was apparently frightening to a lot of the residents just to see these huge planes. They were 500 feet above the ground, that's it. 1,000 feet, dropping these enormous incendiary bombs. Yeah, they burned up 100,000 people. That's less than we burned up in Dresden, but it's the same psychosis, same satanic evil, same thing. Dresden was a horror. The firebombing of Tokyo was a horror. Apparently, if you really look at history objectively, America is, in many ways, not the people, but the American government is the great Satan on the planet.
The evil empire. So let's see. I was going to mention that So anyone might ask, how do I know this, and what is this information source, which is not just reliable, but the most reliable which can be imagined? Well, the Hiroshima bomb was, a uranium bomb. And in those days, the airmen were allowed to give their B-29s names, and they could paint a logo,
right,
and title on the side of it.
Yeah.
And famously, the Hiroshima uranium bomb, that B-29 was called the Enola Gay.
Yeah.
Because that was the mother of the pilot. Isn't that?
That is a little bit weird when you think of all the other bomber art of World War II, and the guy put his mother's name on the plane with his. I forget what the artwork was. Was there any artwork or just the lettering? Can't remember.
I don't quite remember either. Could
I'll
have been just the lettering. Yeah.
I'll look it up.
Yeah. So.
It's just the lettering.
Uh-huh,
that's all.
Uh-huh. Yep. So there was a Pursuit B-29, which had all the cameras and the data acquisition gear.
Yes.
And it had a bombardier on it also, but they didn't bomb anything. They were, you know, getting the scientific data. And the name of that man is, and I have that, Kermit Behan. And the name of the Pursuit plane was the Great Artiste. And that title was, in fact, a reference to the bombardier Kermit Behan, because he was the best of the best. And for some reason, he wasn't the one who was the bombardier on the Hiroshima bombing, but on the really important one with the plutonium bomb, which was going down to destroy the center of Christian life in Japan for 400 years, that was, in fact, Kermit Behan. So an example of going with the best that you had.
So interesting.
And I think I may have read that he was promoted multiple times after the war. Well, you might think that all of those airmen would be under a lifetime gag order about revealing details of the history-making flight, but they were not. So before I mention what Kermit Behan said, let me mention another interesting story of what the pilot said.
One other quick little footnote about a quick advancement. Captain William Parsons, the architect of Port Chicago, and other amazing events, he was a brilliant engineer, was suddenly promoted to Rear Admiral, even though he's never been in charge of a ship. So there you go.
Yep, and he was the weaponeer who armed the Hiroshima bomb, which meant crawling down into a horizontal position in this custom bomb bay where the bomb was taking up, you know, almost all of the space.
Yep.
And there's more to arming the bomb than just flipping a switch. And I haven't seen this recently, but a while ago, it seemed that there was a port that had to be opened, and a primer material had to be tamped in. And that was a few grams. So the primer was a few grams, the few grams which existed in the world of some radioactive element, which is not plutonium or uranium, if I'm remembering correctly. So that was Parsons who did that. Parsons was on the Pursuit plane, the Great Artiste. And one of his, accomplishments was that, or distinction might be a better word, officially he's given credit for having been the one person who personally witnessed all eight of the first atom bomb explosions, including after the war, there was Operation Crossroads in the Pacific, where they took some old Navy ships, and I don't think the hydrogen bomb was available quite yet, but it was a demonstration of what the atom bomb could do against Navy ships. And then Rear Admiral Parsons organized that. It points out the breadth of his achievement, but also how deeply he was involved with testing. And I'll come back to that, but I don't want to lose my place here.
Go ahead.
So the official U.S. government story of what happened with the bomb coming down on its intended target has changed quite a few times. Dionysius I mentioned this, so I won't go over that again. But officially, the original target was a. Didn't I just mention 3 miles away there was a shipyard,
Mitsubishi shipyard.
Mitsubishi shipyard, which was not damaged. And what they said is that the weather was overcast, and that's why a mistake was made with where the bomb came down. And it was just accidentally came down on the center of Christian life for almost 400 years in Japan.
How many Christians were approximately in Japan at that time? Do we know? Percentages even? I don't care. We now it's down to 1.5, but thereabouts.
Yeah. I think it's probably in Dionysius' book, but I don't have that offhand.
Okay.
So the thing is, this man Kermit Behan was the bombardier on the airplane with the plutonium bomb, and the pilot of that was Major Bock, B-O-C-K.
Boxcar.
And the name of Boxcar, kind of a weak pun. But
Kermit was in the chase plane of the Hiroshima blast. Which one did he arm?
Then-Captain...
Parsons armed one of them, but which... Well, Parsons... Yeah. Parsons was on the Enola Gay. All right.
Yes.
And Kermit was where in that run? Was he involved in that at all?
Yes, he was on the Great Artiste.
Okay, following along, but he wasn't the bombardier of that particular bomb. All right.
That's right.
Got it.
That's right.
Thank you.
So let's see. According to Major Bock, and I think it was a major at the time this happened, in his memoirs, and it is surprising to me that this get out and they allowed him to say this, but he was given a handgun before the flight went off, which was a .45 and a cyanide capsule. And he was ordered that if the airplane had to land anywhere but the place where it took off from, which was Tinian Island, he was to shoot all of his crew dead and then take the cyanide capsule.
Oh, how nice.
And so, yes, and in Dionysius' book, he mentions that after that plane went off, the crew became aware that the backup fuel tank was not accessible. So they were only going to barely have enough fuel to get to its target and come back.
A one-way trip.
Well, it however...
Did you say you had enough to get back or not?
They barely just had enough to get back.
Oh, okay.
And at that time, the runway was a whirlwind of activity with lots of planes taking off and landing. and they asked permission to land, and they couldn't get it according to Major Bach. So they started
after dropping the bomb. They couldn't get landing clearance at their home field.
Yes. Wow. And so they went around in circles for the longest time, and eventually they, he told the the tower, like it or not, we're coming in. And Bach said it was so busy, it's kind of a miracle there wasn't a collision, but there wasn't one. And afterwards, they measured how much fuel was left, and it was some tiny amount. So that's very strange.
What the hell is that about? Did they want the plane to crash? Is it, I mean, the control mechanism of this whole thing? They wanted them all to die. No witnesses, right? Dead men tell no tales. Wow.
That still doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but on the surface of it.
How else can you interpret that? Come on, Bach's coming back with his plane. They've dropped the plutonium bomb on Nagasaki, and he can't get clearance? They should have waved everybody else off, obviously. These men are allegedly heroes, right?
Yes.
Oh, that's crazy. That is wild.
Yes, I agree. But the bombardier Kermit Behan, who was actually the great artiste, the best of the best bombardiers that they had, said that while there was a new bomb site in use, and while it was new, they had been practicing with it, and it was based on radar, and therefore the overcast would not have been a problem. And Kermit Behan says in his memoirs, it landed where it was supposed to land, and there's a technical term he uses, which might be, if I'm remembering correctly, if the bomb lands within 500 yards, if I'm remembering correctly, that's considered,
a hit.
A bullseye, basically. Right. Better than that. It was kind of like a bullseye. And he's the person I say is, because the most reliable information source which can be imagined, frankly. So the intended target was, in fact, the center of Christian life in Japan for 400 years.
Dear friends, when we talk on this program, and have for decades, about symbolic actions, here's a prime example of that. There's so much more going on than the average person would ever understand. And this is just something that is on the surface of it. Go ahead, please.
And one idea which Dionysi puts forward is that perhaps the question to why did they have to do it at Bohemian Grove is that, there is the famous 40-foot stone owl, which is a symbol of the Babylonian religion. And every year they have a ritual called the cremation of care, in which an effigy of a human being is burnt. And some people say, well, maybe it isn't just a effigy and there's a human baby or someone. But that's human sacrifice and fire symbology. And David Dionysi makes the point that the firebombing and even the plutonium bombing of the helpless Nagasaki was, in fact, a ritual a slaughter of innocents with, a fire sacrifice.
Another ritualized sacrifice of humanity. Yes, this happens all the time. Some people suggest that World War II was, in its totality, the same kind of thing. And I wouldn't argue that. This is awful, the whole thing.
Well, look at what they did with their one and only available plutonium bomb, which was their best bomb. So at that time...
Drop it on a Catholic church. Come on, a Christian church.
Instead of a military target such as the foremost aircraft factory, which was underground at that time, but if they knew where it was, they could, use the bomb on that. And actually, Where to go from here? I guess the other thing I was going to mention.
Well, ritualized human sacrifice, human slaughter. All right, let's go back to Germany. How many times when they switched in 1943 from bombing military targets to civilian targets? That's what the Allied bombers did. They began to kill as many German people as they could. Right.
Yep.
And we move right on forward, and it's slaughter after slaughter after slaughter. There's something wrong with this species, or its controllers have made it this way. You choose.
And Americans seem to be very blasé about it, and they're very happy to accept the idea, which is refuted by Dainese right on the front cover. The text I read, the United States Strategic Bombing Survey interviewed hundreds of Japanese leaders, and they said that the Japanese would have surrendered in 1945 without the use of the atomic bomb.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. So just one more thing to mention about Port Chicago and Captain Parsons. The official... a story from the U.S. military. People might ask, well, the plutonium bomb was tested at Los Alamos on July 16th, 1945, as everyone knows. And by the way, Jeff, I tried to watch the three-hour Oppenheimer movie over the weekend. And they don't have much... My review is thumbs way down on it. I can't imagine who could sit through 3 hours of this dour boredom. But Captain,
that's
Parsons,
a very interesting review. D-O-U-R, dour or doer, as some people say, boredom. 3 hours of boredom, and it got 13 Academy Awards, right, from the.
An all-time record.
And
won all kinds of box office awards, like the most successful movie ever made, which was a biography.
And what they were doing with that movie was simply creating, recreating, contriving history. Because people will look at that and most people will accept it. That's the way it was. They don't argue anything anymore.
Yes, and how cunning to get people to actually leave their homes and go to a movie theater and pay for admission with their own discretionary, you know, income. That
got
only
it.
Rubs it in even deeper.
Yeah.
But I was going to mention that if we look at Captain Parsons' career trajectory, he was an absolute genius with engineering testing. And
arguably he's our greatest military engineer, period.
Yeah. And he was very hands-on, as we know. He armed the uranium bomb over Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And it's my inference. You mentioned you'd read last time an article from somewhere that there's reason to believe that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was actually not only on the West Coast, but watching the test of the Port Chicago bomb, watching from the shore of San Francisco Bay.
Right.
And if we look at the other book mentioned here, which is Daisy Herndon's book, which was entitled, I'm very, very impressed by her in this book, American Nuclear Deception, Why the Port Chicago Experiment Must Be Investigated. That's also available from as a Kindle book from Amazon. But she goes into detail about why is it's completely believable that FDR had made this very unexpected trip to the West Coast, that he was probably in person there watching it.
Of course.
I will go further and say I know who is standing directly next to him. It had to be Captain Parsons himself. He wouldn't trust anyone else to push the lever or, you know, push the button to make the Port Chicago a bomb go off. We know he was an effective fanatic about testing. So this is the point I'm getting to. the official word about when people ask, okay, we know all about the plutonium bomb, which was tested at Los Alamos with all the physicists in there safely in their concrete bunker. So there were no fatalities this time around. There was 321 first time, but they knew what to expect from the blast radius, and they created a safe space for themselves. And when they looked at the explosion, they looked through the kind of dark glass which is in the visors of the welders.
The flash, of course.
Yep. So they... So people might ask, and of course that three-hour movie was all about that test. So anyone might ask, okay, well, how about the test of the uranium bomb? It was a much simpler bomb.
At Port Chicago, right?
Yes, but...
they should have made the movie about Parsons.
Yes, but the official word is that there was no test of the uranium bomb, and when it was dropped over Hiroshima, it had never been tested.
A first. They're not going to do that. That's ridiculous, of course.
Would Captain Parsons do that? Of course
no.
not.
It's
beyond belief. It didn't happen.
You know what I'm thinking? Yeah. That, Walter, that Parsons, whatever he was tamping into the uranium bomb to trigger it in that second blast at Nagasaki, 1945. Which one did he tamp the whatever it was?
The uranium bomb?
Okay. Yeah. Whatever that was may have given him cancer, because he died only 8 years later, 1953, at 52 years of age. I would suggest he might have died of cancer.
Yeah, possibly. Well, Jeff, there was something else I was hoping to talk about tonight. I don't know if we've run out of time already.
You're welcome to come back again. We can do part four.
Okay.
Let's do that. Then we won't have to crunch and push everything together. What you've all heard in these first three parts, and we'll do part four on Wednesday if that's okay with Walter, is the story, and we recommend highly Daisy Herndon's book, and then you have another one added today, which you can see in the images, the photos. It's one of the biggest outrages that this military-industrial complex, our alleged government, has ever perpetrated against Americans. One quick word, what about the uranium aspect of the uranium bomb at Port Chicago? Was there any radiation involved that you knew about? It measured? Go ahead.
Well, somewhere on your website is the only link in the world to the treasure trove of Port Chicago research documents, which I think was put up there by Peter Vogel himself.
I will put that up. I'm putting a new featured story, a permanent featured story, in the right-hand column about Walter Wilkinson's appearances here. We'll have all four parts when we have the fourth, and I'll also put in there the treasure trove link. So that'll be there on the homepage permanently.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Because it is vulnerable because it's the only one in the world, and it could disappear. And next time there's another document I want to talk about, which also is very, very extraordinarily important, but is vulnerable. So let's see. I had a final thing. So I guess that's it for this time around, and we'll talk again on Wednesday.
Okay. Well, this is really fabulous what you've done, and thank you. You've made a major contribution to rolling away the darkness and the clouds and letting the sunshine on the truth. And that's what we really like about this. This is what journalism is supposed to be. Your contribution will be permanent And everyone will, I'm sure, be listening to these for a long time to come. So we'll talk on Wednesday. And thank you, Walter, very much again.
Thank you, Jeff. Good night.
Okay.
Bye now.
Good night. What a remarkable story. Terrific research. Phenomenal. And we'll come back with part 4 on Wednesday. Don't miss it. Back in a few.